Hello, and welcome to our policy forum today on the net choice cases and the future of online speech. My name is Jennifer Huddleston, and I'm a technology policy research fellow here at the Cato Institute. I'd like to thank those of you who are joining us here today at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C., as well as the many of you that are joining us online. And particularly for those of you joining us online, this case should be of high interest, should be of interest to any of us that are active users of online platforms or who care deeply about free speech. While we'll often hear these cases discussed in the terms of quote-unquote big tech, as we'll hear in our various panels today, the impact of these cases could be much farther reaching, not only for a wide variety of online platforms, but for the future of First Amendment jurisprudence, as well as for individual internet users. We look forward to discussing all of those issues today in our various panels. We will have time for Q&A during each of our panels today. And if you're joining us online, you can submit questions using the hashtag Cato1A via Twitter or X, as well as via the question and answer form on other platforms. We'll go over more details with each panel in terms of how to submit questions, and we look forward to what should be an engaging conversation. With that in mind, I am very excited to welcome to the Cato Institute Steve Del Bianco, the founder, president, and CEO of NetChoice, the named plaintiffs in this case, and who has been, I believe this is the first time you've gotten to sit down for such a Q&A since the oral arguments on Monday. So welcome, Steve. Thank you for being here.
Jen, I'm so glad to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much. So to start with, for those who are not familiar with NetChoice, we've heard these cases referred to as the NetChoice cases. The named plaintiffs are yourselves and another trade association, CCIA. What is NetChoice, and why are you guys the plaintiffs in these cases?
Yeah, thank you, Jen, and appreciate being here. The first thing I should do, though, is to thank you as our hosts at Cato, but also thank our co-plaintiff, the CCIA Trade Association. It's an arrangement of who's named first, and the NetChoice cases should be known as the NetChoice CCIA cases. They've been a great partner to us. I also want to acknowledge Cato for an outstanding amicus brief that you filed in this case, along with the other panelists here today from Tech Freedom, CGO, and Engine. And all of that helped to make the huge difference. You asked about NetChoice, and NetChoice is a trade association. Our members are all listed on the website, and the same tech companies that all of us use every day, including social media sites. Our mission is pretty simple, to make the internet safe for free enterprise and free expression. And you would think that would be easy given the origins of the web 20 years ago, but today, that notion of free enterprise and free expression online are under assault from both sides of the political aisle.
You know, you mentioned that you guys are a tech trade association, and you're deeply in the world of tech and tech policy. My own research focuses on tech policy, but these cases in some ways are bigger than tech policy. What would you say for someone who's not constantly focused on tech policy, or, you know, you yourself are not a lawyer, you work with some excellent lawyers, someone who's not a lawyer, what should they understand about the NetChoice cases and what it might mean?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the best way to do that is to start with the origin of the NetChoice cases. If you think back to the election of 2020 and the Hunter Biden laptop scandal, and the degree to which some social media sites, for days or perhaps hours, would reduce the amount of sharing of the Hunter Biden story because they wanted to ensure that it wasn't hacked material or terrorist-disseminated information. Well, that gave rise to quite a bit of resentment from Trump followers and voters. And sure enough, after January the 6th, we saw a situation where Trump looked as if he might actually disappear from the political stage. And that was not lost on Governor DeSantis, who had significant political ambitions and believed one way to seize the affections of Trump followers was to quickly punish the tech companies, the big tech companies, that had deplatformed Trump after January the 6th. That was the political origin of the Florida law that we sued in NetChoice v. Florida. It didn't take long for Governor Abbott in Texas to follow suit with his own copy of that law just a few months later. So that origin story of those bills caused NetChoice, a lobbying organization, along with many others in this room, to descend upon Tallahassee and Austin, Texas, to lobby in front of committees, multiple committees, House and Senate, to try to explain that the state itself could not force social media what to carry and what to take down. I remember asking the chairman of two committees, I said, could you enact a law that would force the local newspaper to carry your op-eds? And the chairman answered, well, of course not. And I said, so what makes you believe you could force Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, names at the time, to carry content that they don't want to carry, you know, in offense of their user base and their advertisers? That origin story then advanced to a crescendo of court challenges at different levels and appellate decisions, an emergency appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court in May of 2022. And along the way, many of you in this room filed briefs. There were 77 helpful amicus briefs filed in these cases, among them 223 amici, many in this room today. And I think that you guys kept the fires alive for these cases and for the First Amendment. I guess that's why we call this a fireside chat. You feel the heat coming from the seats here. And that odyssey brought us to where we were today, where there continues to be political sentiments that tech is somehow not kind to conservatives. I think that as a conservative, I find it to be the opposite. Tech is killing it on social media. We get far more ability to share our news and views with like-minded conservatives on social media than we ever did on traditional media before.
I appreciate your comment that we can call this a fireside chat because of all the heat on the First Amendment, because I have a friend who always gives criticism about the false advertising of fireside chats like this without a fire. You mentioned that when you were testifying before the Florida committees, you brought up, could you force a newspaper to run an op-ed? That sounds really similar to one of the questions we heard during oral arguments. We'll have an entire panel after this about oral arguments, but I was wondering if you could speak a little bit, you know, as the named plaintiff, of what did you feel about oral arguments, and if you're willing to say even, how do you think they went?
Yeah, great question. I feel great about how things went on Monday, and I was in the courtroom and fascinated, you know, riveted to my seat for 4 hours, which is difficult for somebody my age, I can tell you. But I would say two things that I would observe as a takeaway, and then one stylistic element. The first is that the notion of common carriers was a big bet for the states. It's the opening paragraph of both the laws that we sued over, this notion that they could simply declare the social media companies that NetChoice represents to be common carriers, and if that somehow paved the way for them to kick the First Amendment to the curb. And I think we heard from justices across that panel that common carrier, even if it could be applied to our companies, would not deprive of us the protections that the First Amendment grants. I think that was a huge step in the direction of showing the states that they would have a long way to go. So as good as I feel about how it went Monday, I have to believe that lawyers for Texas and Florida are not feeling so good if they lose that foundational element of common carrier. Another item that came up was the discussion of Section 230. And again, we have three justices, Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch, who have written before in the 2022 decision on whether to enjoin the Texas law. They believe that big tech has, in their belief, needs to be reined in. And that belief leads them to reach for elements of an argument that could persuade the other justices. So we did hear some discussion of whether Section 230 created some inherent contradiction with the First Amendment protections that we were asserting. And I believe that we were able to show that Section 230 really has nothing to do with the First Amendment protections that we're asserting. And I think that will emerge as a distraction, but it does indicate that if you're in the room watching the justices question, they're not always directing their questions to the counsel and advocate at the table in front. Often the questions are directed to other justices on the panel in an effort to acknowledge, persuade, and bring them over to their side, because it's all about striving to get to 5 votes. And so that was apparent as well. It will take 4 more months. And over that period of time, I have to believe that other cases will bear heavily on their thinking and how they write. And I want you to remember this notion of the Missouri v. Biden, now known as Murty v. Missouri, is coming up shortly. Cato, others, many did amicus briefs in that case, and it helps to focus when groups like NetChoice, CCIA, Cato, all of it together on one amicus brief that I think will help to make a big difference on that. That Murthy case will be a triangulation of the Texas and Florida cases. The Texas and Florida seemed like they were far apart because the laws themselves had different reach. But once you position the Murthy case against them, I believe we've created the perfect storm of cases, and the Supreme Court will have an opportunity to erect a real wall to signify what the First Amendment is. And the first foundation of that wall in our cases is to say that this wall prevents the government from directly and formally forcing us to carry speech we don't want to carry or to take down speech we prefer to keep up. Well, they need to extend that wall with a ruling in Murthy. Put another 10 feet on top of that great, big, beautiful wall to show that governments and government regulators, they cannot informally, they cannot indirectly cajole, persuade, or pressure social media to carry speech we don't want to carry or take down what they don't like. So it's a perfect opportunity to build a significant barrier so that the First Amendment bars government as it's intended to do.
Yes, this is certainly going to be quite the term at the Supreme Court, not only for quote-unquote tech issues, but really for free speech in general. And this is following what last year was a quite significant term where we saw the cases of Google v. Gonzalez and Twitter v. Tamna. We also saw a ruling in 303 Creative that seemed to relate perhaps to some of the conversations we heard, particularly from Justice Gorsuch in oral arguments yesterday. But I want to turn to something that's almost a little funny to me. We mentioned last term, we mentioned this term, you know, we have a significant number of tech policy or free speech focused cases. Our event today is called The Net Choice Cases and the Future of Online Speech. And I have to laugh to myself a little bit because when I say the net choice cases, right now we mean the two cases that were heard at oral arguments on Monday. But there are a lot of cases that could be called the net choice cases. In fact, I've lost count of how many cases your very active litigation center has been involved in. Can you tell us a little bit about some of those other cases that we might hear referred to as the net choice cases if, say, we were having this conversation this fall or even next year?
Oh, great question. You can still count them on one hand, the cases that have been adjudicated. But in California, Arkansas, Utah, and Ohio, we saw states enact laws that are very different than the Florida-Texas laws affecting content moderation, but are just similar to Florida and Texas in that they run headlong into this wall of the First Amendment. So I can quickly summarize them in turn. All of these laws, in an effort to send the message that they want to protect minors online, not children necessarily, but minors, people up to in the age of 17 or 18. They are forcing all of us of any age to turn over sensitive personal credentials in order to be able to use the digital services that we use today. Social media services, after all, includes anything that is user-generated content. And if you check your Google search, all of the results that come back are user-generated content. The same is true of Wikipedia. Same is true, of course, of Facebook, of X, of YouTube, and a plethora of social media services. None of those would be accessible to anyone under 18, which means that all of us have to prove that we are over 18, even if we're as old as I am, in order to use the services we use today. And we'd have to also establish accounts online to do that, whereas today we might just go to youtube.com without bothering to log in or use an account. So the requirement that all of us turn over sensitive personal credentials and information is a chilling effect on free speech and runs headlong into the First Amendment. And that's what we argued. We argued and received rulings this year. In Arkansas, we had a preliminary injunction granted in August. In California, against the age-appropriate design code, we had our injunction granted in September of 2023. California is appealing. Arkansas decided not to appeal, which I think is telling. And then in December, we had the state of Utah, whose credential law also included the requirement of a curfew that would prevent anyone under 18 from using social media online from the hours of 10:30 p.m. till 6:30 a.m. How that would work with a 17-year-old needing to do research on Google search or any other of the social tools, I don't know. And then finally, just earlier this month, we were granted a preliminary injunction against an Ohio age-appropriate design law. So that's a total of four, and I'm sure there'll be more. And we'll definitely need to count on help from those of you who've been so helpful on our cases against Texas and Florida. to keep up the lobbying, keep up the amicus briefs, the articles, because these cases will have a long way to go.
Well, I certainly have more questions I could ask, but we do have a few minutes left. Are you okay if I take a question from our audience? Does anyone in our live audience have a question for Mr. Del Bianco?
You know, I might say that the importance here of keeping the fires burning is the thing to walk away from here, is that all of you who think that now we can just take a rest for the next 4 months, it's not just the four cases that Jen has just discussed with me, but it's the actual cases in Florida and Texas. Staff and the justices will read the things that Cato puts out, the events that Cato puts on, the articles and events that the rest of you write. So we should work together to try to generate the impression that the First Amendment needs to have two levels of wall and that it needs to include a ruling in Murty.
I think we have a question from Ronnie.
Hi. Granted that the Congress is not good at writing laws and even less good at writing laws that will restrict speech and get into governing private companies that carry speech, are there some things that you would recommend for the social media to do to deal with the problems that the new laws are aimed at, namely, you know, bullying and suicide and hate speech? And are there ways that you would recommend that companies can actually moderate or deal with these problems so that the government doesn't have to get into it?
Yeah, a brief answer. I know you're short on time. Thank you for the question. And in all of our testimony at the state level, in Congress, and counseling with respect to the COSA legislation, we have always said that the first element is to ensure that parents and children are educated about the controls that they can take, the steps that they can take, how they handle bullying if they confront it in the online world, much like we teach our kids how to handle bullying that occurs in the physical world. So education of parents and children at the appropriate age is essential. So we have worked hard to help Governor DeSantis enact that law in Florida. We have the same law in Virginia that requires school districts to include curriculum about safe online conduct. A second element is social media platforms do an incredible job of identifying inappropriate material, particularly child sexual abuse material, or CSAM. We turn over tens of millions of instances of those photographs that are being shared, sometimes through direct messages and sometimes through the social media platforms. Well, only a tiny fraction of the reports that we turn over are investigated, let alone prosecuted. So something that state and federal governments need to do is to provide more funding for the district attorneys, the prosecutors, and investigators to take anyone straight to court if they're involved in distributing child sexual abuse material or involved in grooming children using social media and other online platforms or bullying children. I think those are concrete steps that can make a difference immediately without any interference by the First Amendment.
Thank you so much. And I know there's a lot of things to really dive into on this case. Next, we're going to turn it over to my colleague, Tommy Berry, from our Center for Constitutional Studies here at the Cato Institute, to dive into some of what happened at oral arguments, both the things that I think many of us who have been following this case expected to come up. You mentioned common carrier, and that certainly has been quite the debate, as well as some of the perhaps more unexpected things that came up in oral arguments and what this may mean for various elements of our jurisprudence around the First Amendment and the internet going forward. But I'd ask our audience to join me in thanking Steve for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Thank you, Jen.